So we begin with paradise, which clearly is different from the earthly paradise. There are two paradises. We went through the earthly paradise. This is, anyway, we begin the third canticle, which is called Paradise. And as you read, you'll find that Dante uses a Ptolemaic structure of the cosmos. A Ptolemaic structure means that for him, as for Ptolemy, the Earth is at the center of the universe, unmoved, immobile, and there are a number of seven planets that circle around it. The moon is thought of as a planet, Mercury, the sun, then there will be Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. Beyond that, there is this the heaven of the so-called fixed stars, and beyond that, the primum, the Empyrean, the heaven of fire, from which all motion begins, from which time starts. That's really where the roots of time are found, and they stretch out into the finite world, so that we really are in the shadows of the leaves of time, which means that they are always falling and being replaced. Another thing you have to keep in mind as you go into paradise is that Dante links the each of the planets with, I have said this before, I know, but it bears repeating, with one of the liberal arts. And they're respectively, the liberal arts are the seven liberal arts, and then there are two more, since there are nine heavens. It begins with grammar in the planet of the moon. And so you have to expect that you will find the language of grammarians, grammar, the moon, and grammar, a very wide definition of what grammar can be. It includes poetry, it includes history, even includes some rhetorical tropes. And then the heaven of Mercury with dialectics. And so you're expecting to find the language of dialectics deployed, and it's going to be the deployed throughout the canto. The heaven of Venus and rhetoric, that probably is the least surprising. Eros and rhetoric have an old kinship. They seem to entail each other. Then the heaven of Mars, the god of war, which here Dante couples with music, in the persuasion that music is a harmony made of discordant parts, so that there is a kind of simultaneously a pull and a strife within the heaven of Mars, so that, or music. Then beyond it, there's geometry linked with the temperateness of Jupiter, and beyond it, astronomy and or Saturn. The heaven of the fixed stars is linked to ethics, whereas the heaven of the Empyrean is really the heaven of metaphysics, as Dante will call it. And you will see the kind of interesting arguments that Dante will have, because in effect he has changed his mind when writing the philosophical text known as the Banquet, and you know now, the Convivio, he writes it in Italian. He had really claimed that ethics is the first and the most important of the arts. It's really the discipline toward which all the art, to which all the other arts are subordinated and toward which they all point. When Dante writes the Paradiso, he has changed his mind about that. Though he also knows that in many ways you cannot quite separate ethics, whatever he means by ethics, with some theory about how the world is. They really are inseparable, and Dante will go on back and forth in configuring the relation of those two disciplines. The other thing that I should mention before we go on is that much of the Paradiso really is going to come through as a way of, as a teaching. It's already implied that this should be the thrust of Paradiso, but the very idea that there is the disposition of the arts and sciences in through Paradiso, which means that the journey that Dante will have, this cosmological journey, it's an interplanetary journey. He goes from planet to planet. It's already an educational journey. So he goes through grammar, rhetoric, dialectic, et cetera, till he reaches metaphysics, or beyond that there will be theology. So it's literally an educational journey. And this is already understood also, it's already carried out by the focus on the teaching that Beatrice will deliver. So I have to say a couple of things. That Dante's teacher in Paradise, and this is an innovative, very imaginative and highly unusual move on the part of a poet, is not some kind of abstract matron called Dame philosophy. It's not some kind of allegory of nature. You know, you do have this kind of allegorical, didactic allegories where nature appears as largely disheveled woman, wounded, it's because nature is fallen, teaching the pilgrim or the traveler about the secrets of nature and the wealth of nature. Here is a personal, his girlfriend, to be sure, and it's someone who therefore also replaces all the other likely candidates for this teaching, which is would be Aquinas, Boethius, Bonaventure, all figures that he's going to meet. It's a mistake to believe, however, that as some great scholars of Dante have said in the past, that Paradiso is really a journey to Beatrice. That's what they say. That's not the case, because Beatrice will disappear from, I mean, she will still be within view up to a point in Paradise, but her role ends with Canto 30 of Paradiso, and from that point on, a mystic by the name of Bernard, a historical figure, Bernard of Clairvaux, will take place. So this leads me now to a further clarification. There may be the tendency in some of you to view the Paradiso as some kind of account of a mystical experience. You know what I'm saying, that Dante sort of goes beyond his own self, beyond any idea of rational understanding of the world, the surrendering of his own subjectivity to some insight into the whole. This, I don't think that this is what's happening here. Dante will preserve his rationality and his sense of distinction and separation from some kind of cosmic or cosmological and cosmic whole till the very end. There is a way in which Dante will deploy the language of the mystics, and I want to give you some evidence of that, because I think that it opens up an interesting chapter for your further readings. But this is not to be read as a kind of a transcription of a mystical experience where the text then goes on in some kind of random approximation or random copying of what the mystics saw and becomes ineffable. Dante uses occasionally, toward the end, the language of ineffability, but this remains a poetic construction, an imaginative projection into what is a journey into the absolute unknown, into a space no other imagination had really traveled, and have been those who had traveled there, but they never really came back to tell us. Dante will play with that. His is, to use a language, a way of getting into that which had been left inarticulate and silent. It's really largely a battle against for a poet, threatening boundaries of silence, something that threatens him with defeat. He would not be able to speak. And from one point of view, that defeat for the Christian could also be, of course, a victory, but Dante is suspended between the two the two poles. If I had to define, and I have already given a kind of general definition, what kind of aegis and which rubric should we try to go on reading this part of the poem? I really think this is really a poem about beauty, in the sense that Dante will try to understand what the beauty is. Beauty is the visibility of Plotinus, says this. It's the visibility of being, he calls it. Being, life, the whole of life becomes visible only because we have perceptions and images of it. So I think that Dante is trying to see that, to explore what is that lies beyond that which we see. What is this beauty skin deep, as it were? Because that's really one of the dangers of focusing on beauty, that it's really the surface of things, the appearance of things. And he will go between appearances, images, and some essence, the idea that there are essences lying beyond them. Okay, so I really have said more or less all I had to say in the mode of an introduction. And I immediately get into the Canto 1. Let me just read Canto 1 a little bit with in some detail. The glory, that's the way it starts, the glory of him who moves all things penetrates the universe and shines in one part more and in another less. That's the first tercet, famous first tercet. And I will read this in Italian so that you sense how even the rhythm of the poem completely changes. The rhythm and even the syntactical structure of the poem. Because you may recall, and I say this knowing that you have already noticed that if you read Canto 1 of Inferno, or Canto 1 of Purgatorio, the two exordiums of the other canticles, you know that the poet is immediately casting himself into the role of the agent, right? In the middle of the journey of my life, I found myself. That's really the very start of Inferno 1. And in Purgatorio 2, to course over better waters, the boat of my genius now goes, and I will sing. You remember? Not so in Paradise. There is a way in which immediately the first tercet, which is a kind of sort of proemial value, seeks to bracket the idea of the self and the idea of the subjectivity. It emphasizes the question of God becomes the agent here, to say it in a very direct, as direct as he says, the glory. It's a circumlocution once again, but let me read it in Italian so that I can give you a sense, as I said, of the new music that he has found, the new sense of the inner harmony that toward which language you have to strive. La gloria di colui che tutto muove per l'universo penetra e risplende in una parte più e meno altrove. That's it. And it's rendered very, very faithfully by St. Clair. I don't know the other translations, but probably they can't deviate from each moment very much. And I read it in Italian because I also would like you, and you, this is understandable to the eye, if not just to the ear for you, how he's playing with, in line one, the glory of him who all moves, so God, the mover, I'll talk about it in a little more, the one who moves all, and that all then becomes one in the next line, universe. The all becomes that which is turned into one. That's what etymologically, the universe. And then it goes on, penetrates and the universe and shines in one part more and in another less. The tercet casts God. This is about God. It's a circumlocution. He's not. It's really a God who is visible through God's effects. God appears as kind of cause. Now, then, if you really understand the effects, it means there's a causality. I don't want to get into too much into that, but you know what I mean. That simple. You only know the effects. You know the glory. We see the glory, which is the light. Glory. It's a semantic. First, the first thing we have to say, this is a shift, a change in the history of the word. That's what poets do. When we say that poets invent, reinvent language, that's largely what they do. They change the meaning of words. Glory in the classical time and all the way down to the Renaissance and the Romantic age, glory means fame, means it's the child of Clio, means the power we have to survive, you know, to have a posthumous life because of whatever noble deeds heroes may have achieved. That's not what it means here. Glory means light. It's of course the light of one's fame, if you wish, but this is the light emphasized. And why do we know that? Because light now is linked to two verbs of the glory of him who moves all things, penetrates the universe and shines. So you see there is a metaphor of light that is conveyed here. So the first tercet presents God in a cosmological role, which is double, one of motion and one of light, two things. Dante's combining an Aristotelian idea of God as the prime mover, the one who imparts motion to all things, and the second image is that of God as the principle of light, a Neoplatonic idea. So he's fusing together two apparently contradictory traditions, light and motion. One is talking in terms of causality, and the other one really, I'm not going to go much further than this, the other one in terms of, because light does that, penetrates, shines all over, according to a principle of hierarchy, more and less. There is no uniformity in with light, and I'll come back to this notion in a moment. So one idea casts God as the prime mover according to the tradition of Aristotelian philosophy. The other one thinks of God as in the mode of light or participation. There are two different theological modes. God participates, is part of creation, right? The natural world is part of the supernatural world. It's not just a causality that begins all things and then somehow retreats in some sort of invisible and unknown non-space of its own. The other item in this first tercet is that I want to emphasize is the principle of hierarchy. Light shines more and less. I have been hinting at this, that this is really a great problem for Dante in other parts of the poem. You remember, to course over better waters, Dante says in Purgatorio 1. And that implies, of course, that they are bad, good, better, best, that we are in the principle of hierarchy. Differences are very crucial for Dante because they allow us to know things only through differences, and also because these differences, and that's the value of hierarchy, are still combined in some kind of unified structure. Hierarchy is a structure that unifies all differences according to the principle of degree. More of this a little bit later as we go on. And then Dante now, because I said that he's not a mystic, subjectivity is not erased. Mystics tend, though they all claim a unique vision, they all end up resembling each other when they talk about the ineffable. Dante introduces now the subject, and he says, I was in the heaven that most receives his light. That is to say, past in the Empyrean, which is sort of spiritual. He was in as close to God as it can be. which will also be as far from God as it can be. I was in the heaven that most receives his light, and I saw things which he that descends from it has not the knowledge or the power to tell again. So no sooner does Dante introduce his subjectivity as and his way of knowing, and out of this intimacy of and closeness to the beatific vision, then he has also to cast himself as a visionary, as the knowledge or the power to tell. I saw things, and you will see how Dante goes on refining his eyesight. A little detail that you might really enjoy is that we do know that Dante would use lenses, glasses, toward the end of it, had just been invented. You know, there are books written about when were glasses invented. Were they invented in Pisa? Were they invented in Padua? There have been wars going on about this claim. But Dante uses glasses. So he really had difficulty, that's the point, in seeing. And the whole of Paradiso is about the refinement of sight and the refinement of vision, how you are going to be able to attune, as it were, your eyes to the objects around you. Anyway, he casts himself now as a visionary with an internal vision. You know, I'm not casting him as a Homer who is blind and therefore he sees everything with the inner eye, but he wants to be a visionary poet. And I saw things which, this was one who sees things as a whole. That's what the difference between ear. You know, there are great, great debates between the ear and the eye. Is that the ear you hear, and you hear always only from one in a linear way. You know, things can come from all sides, but you can only catch a thing at a time. With the eye, you have the eye is the organ that gives you the chance to, the organ of the contemplatives gives you a chance to see totalities. I saw things which he that descends from it has not the knowledge or the power to tell again. And then he explains why. He explains the status of his poetic language. I saw what is the relationship between language and vision. That's the, if you want to put it in a very abstract way, how are the two related? For our intellect, drawing near to its desire, the intellect yearns, longs for the object that it desires. So there is a desire of the mind, a desire, it's not just a desire of the intellectual desires, sinks so deep that memory cannot follow it. Very simple, forgetfulness intervenes so that he may have an intuition, an insight into things, he cannot quite go on recalling what it. Nevertheless, so much of the Holy Kingdom as I was able to treasure in my mind shall now be matter of my song. So whatever he's going to tell us is literally a shadow of things he manages to remember. And it makes sense that he should not remember, because one of the paradoxes of this poetic construction is the following. He has a beatific vision. How can he retain in his mind the sight, which is finite, that which is infinite, if not through vestiges and if not through shadows? You know, how can my memory, which is a metaphor of time, right? By definition, I remember certain things, but how can I go on remembering and holding that which is without time, which is infinite? So the first paradox in the representation of paradise. Let me go on with the next one, next paragraph now. Dante turns to the god of poets, to Apollo, or good Apollo. For the last labor, make me such a vessel of thy power. He casts himself into a passive mode, a vessel, one who receives. It's the language of restraint. It's the language of holding back. It's in a sense, it's really the classical commonplace, you know, of asking the muse to breathe through us, you know. Sing to me, O muse, remember? The Iliad, and the same, a variant of the same thing, a variation of the same thing happens in the Odyssey. O good Apollo, for the last labor, make me such a vessel of thy power as thou requirest for the gift of thy loved laurel. What an extraordinary image, because he's remembering the story of the god who chases Daphne, the object of his desire, which he cannot really obtain. That's the story in the, you all know the story in the Metamorphoses, but he can only obtain Daphne, which means laurel in Greek, but he only can obtain this young maiden, Daphne, in the form of a metaphor for the laurel crown. So it's a sort of a journey which is somehow the object of which becomes, the possession of the object becomes dislocated, not quite what the god himself wanted. But this introduces something else about the Paradiso. Thus far, the one peak of Parnassus has sufficed me. You may remember this is a recall of the dream of Parnassus in Purgatory that we saw when Statius and Virgil were flattered into believing that what they had dreamt is actually the simulacrum of the earthly paradise. Thus far, the one peak of Parnassus has sufficed me, but now I have need of both. A language of humility, entering into the arena on the arena that remains. It's a struggle now. First of all, he had introduced this image of himself as a vessel receptive to the inspiration of Apollo. Now the language of even violence into the arena where there's a sports, where there is battles are fought, entering into the arena, entering on the arena that remains. And now look at this. Come into my breast and breathe there as when thou drewest Marsyas from the scabbards of his limbs. An echo of the struggle between the poet and the god. Right? He does not want to be like Marsyas, because Marsyas, out of presumption, so that's now you understand the language of restraint and withholding, the out of presumption, Marsyas had tried to outdo Apollo, and of course was defeated by Apollo and flayed by Apollo. Dante does not want to. What this is about is the fear in the battle for the description of paradise, the fear that he may be usurping God's role, the fear that he may be transgressing and violating that which is the sovereign claim of the gods. So he continues now, O power divine. So that's one of the images of a fear of blasphemy, fear of transgression, and this will continue then with the possibility of hubris, in other words. And then it continues, O power divine, if thou grant me so much of thyself that I may show forth the shadow of the blessed kingdom imprinted in my brain, thou shalt see me come to thy chosen tree, the laurel, and crown myself then with those leaves of which the theme and thou will make me worthy. So seldom, Father, are they gathered for triumph of Caesar or poet, fault and shame of human wills, that the pineal bough must beget gladness in the glad Delphic god when it makes any long for it. A great fame for a little spark, etc. And then the lamp of the world, I'm just give you this. Dante is approaching, he's moving, he thinks he's on earth, and he discovers, I will not go on into details, and he discovers that he's on heaven, in on the moon. So he describes here, this is the image at the bottom, page 21, line 65 and following. Beatrice stood with her eyes fixed only on the eternal wheels, and on her I fixed mine, withdrawn from above. At her aspect, I was changed within, as was Glaucus when he tasted of the herb that made him one among the other gods in the sea. It's a story of clearly the pilgrim is moving into another level of experience, another level of being, and he remarks on the transformation that he is undergoing. And the emphasis falls in the distance between the Ovidian account of Glaucus, who believes that he's immortal and jumps into the water after tasting of some herbs, and Dante himself is indicated by that little preposition within. The transformation occurs in Dante from within himself, not in some literal way outside, on the outside. And then he continues, the passing beyond humanity cannot be set forth in words. Let the example suffice, therefore, for him to whom grace reserves the experience. The experience that the pilgrim is having is unique and irreducible, and the poem can only be read as an example, as an account of what has happened to him. And then he continues, if I was only that part of me which thou createst last, thou knowest, love that rules the heaven, who with thy flight didst raise me. And your notes, your footnotes will tell you that this is a reference to the second letter to the Corinthians, chapter 12, by Paul, by Saint Paul, where he also tells the story of his being wrapped to the third heaven. So we have then two accounts in Canto 1 of experiences. One is that of encounters with the divine. One is that of the profanation by Marcius. The other one is by St. Paul, who, as you recall, Dante casts as one of the possible models for him. He says, when at the beginning he has to set out on the journey, he says, I'm not Aeneas, I'm not Paul. Now we see how Paul comes into play. Who am I then? That was the whole thrust of the poem. What happens to Paul? Paul goes to the third heaven, and people have a way of head away in the Middle Ages, especially. They say, why many heavens are there? The third heaven. And what is meant by the third heaven was the third mode of vision. There are levels of vision that they emphasize. There is a literal level, the carnal, worldly level. There is an imaginative vision. And then there is the ecstatic vision that Paul had. But the thing is, in the second letter to the Corinthians, is that Paul went to the third heaven, had the vision of God, the beatific vision. He returned and could not speak about it. He refused because what he saw had to be kept wrapped in silence. So this is now, Dante is between, on the one hand, Marcius and that fear of profanation, and now Paul, it is as if he also is transgressing the teaching of Paul, that the whole of paradise is about limits and the impossibility of establishing clear limits. He will do what Paul himself could not do. Paul kept quiet in the belief that the silence was the proper language of his sublime experience. Dante will go on speaking till it's possible to him to do so, till finally he really has forgotten everything that he has seen. So you see how he's casting himself, his own poetic powers, his own subjectivity, between two different modalities. He doesn't want to go as presumptuously far as Marcius did. He does not want to retreat as Paul did. Okay, I really think that I should let you know. I'll take it's a little digression before we go into the second part of the canto. In Canto 1 and 2, where Dante is really going to face a peculiar issue, the universe I'm in, is it a material universe? That's the thrust of Canto 2. Is this a natural, then part of the natural world or not? Goes on talking about the spots on the moon, etc. We'll come to that. And here in Canto 1, we shall see that he's going to discuss the arrangement of the cosmos. But you have to know, I want to share with you a couple of paragraphs of a letter that Dante writes to introduce paradise. This is what had happened. He lives in Ravenna when he's writing. He's probably Ravenna by the time he writes The Earthly Paradise. As you know, he makes references to the Garden of Eden in terms of the park, the pine wood, the wood of pine trees around the city. And now we do know that he will live and die in Ravenna. But he decides to send the first 10 cantos of paradise to the so-called Khan, the great dog of Verona, who had been his patron for a number of years. And he introduces those 10 cantos that he sends with a letter called the letter to Can Grande in Italian. It's the Dante writes, you know that. This is the 10th letter of a number of letters that he writes. Let me just read this. It's a kind of glossing. It explains the genre of the poem, explains what his models have been, how has to be read. But look what he says about this circumlocution here, about Paul the Apostle. This is from paragraph 27. It's not a really long letter, but I couldn't read the whole thing without putting you all to sleep. The philosopher presents an argument consonant with the above in the first book on heaven. the philosopher meaning Aristotle, where he says that a heaven, quote, has material more honorable than that of other heavens beneath it to the extent that it is more distant than they from the earth. The nobility in a hierarchical structure, the nobility of matter will depend on its proximity to the source of light and life. Okay. And to this might be added what the apostle told the Ephesians concerning Christ, who ascended above all the heavens that he might fill all things. This is the heaven of the Lord's pleasures, to which pleasures Ezekiel refers in accusing Lucifer. Thou wast the seal of resemblance, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. Thou wast in the pleasure of the paradise of God. And after having said in his circumlocution that he was in that part of paradise, he continues, meaning himself, by stating that he saw things which he who descends cannot relate. And he gives the cause of this, saying that the intellect goes so deeply into its desire itself, which is God, that the memory cannot follow. To understand what this means, it should be noted that in this life, the human intellect, because of the affinity it has for the separated intellectual substance with which it shares its nature, reaches such a height of exaltation when it is exalted, that upon its return to itself, having transcended the ordinary capacity of man, memory fails. And this idea is implied to us by the apostle addressing the Corinthians, a passage just read, where he writes, quote, I know a man, whether in the body or out of the body, I know not, God knoweth, who was caught up to the third heaven, and who heard secret words, which it is not granted to man to utter. See, when the intellect had passed beyond the bounds of human capacity in its exaltation, it could not remember what happened outside these bounds. And the same idea is implied to us in Matthew, where the three disciples fell down on their faces and told nothing about it afterwards, as if they had forgotten. And it is written in Ezekiel, quote, I saw and I fell upon my face, end quote. But if these passages don't satisfy the skeptical, let them read Richard of St. Victor in his book on contemplation, or Bernard of Clairvaux in his book on consideration, or Augustine in his book on the capacity of the soul, and they will be no longer skeptical. Or if they should bark out against the possibility of such exaltation because of the sinfulness of the speaker, they should read Daniel, where they would find that even Nebuchadnezzar, by divine permission, saw something which was a warning to sinners and then forgot it. For he who maketh his sun to rise upon the good and bad and raineth upon the just and the unjust manifests his glory to all the living, no matter how evil they are, sometimes mercifully for the sake of the conversion, sometimes harshly as a punishment and to a greater or less degree according to his will. And the reason why I want to share this passage with you is that it really places with some clarity. It casts, it projects a light of that makes things clear about the status of the poem. The poem invokes a number of models which are all in the contemplative philosophical tradition. Or, again, Dante does not eschew the prophetic tradition, but he makes them agree with the same mode of the visionary. You know, you see, that's what the prophets do. They see in order to speak. If you are readers of the Bible, you probably have heard, and you may be right, if you were to believe, that there really is no necessary link in the Bible between vision, between the mystics, those who have visions, and those who are prophets. They are two different experiences, two different states. Not so for Dante. It may be true in the Bible that they are two. Dante thinks that the two will go together. You have a vision in order to speak, and that's really what the... So it helps us understand the sense of poetry with which Dante invokes here at the beginning of Paradiso. Let me go now. Dante has to go on, tries to find out on lines 90 and so, asks a question about what has been happening to him. Now, as he'd been moving, he thought he was on earth in the earthly paradise. Now he seems to be on another planet. Line 95, if I was freed from my perplexity, Beatrice dismisses some fancies of his. You make thyself dull with false fancies, so thou cannot see as thou wouldst if thou had cast them off. You are no longer on earth as you think, but lightning flying from its own place never ran so fast as thou return to thine. The journey, Dantes is traveling so fast, the speed of light, to go from the earthly paradise to the moon. If I was freed from my perplexity, by the brief words she smiled to me, I was more entangled in a new one, and I said, I was content already, resting from a great wonder, but now I wonder how I should be rising above these light substances. Two, three things. One that I should mention to you, and I will never mention them again, but Paradiso is all unfolds the narrative economy with the pilgrim experiencing perplexities and doubts, which Beatrice will clarify, and in turn those responses go on triggering new doubts. So it's really a question of doubts and answers in an unending process of the mind enlarging itself, and always filled with wonder. And that's really the language that I want to start emphasizing for you here, how Dante is using this figure of admiration, he calls it, line 97, or I was content resting from a great wonder, now I wonder, and you will see continues throughout the beginning of Paradise. What is this wonder? It is, first of all, a definition of the aesthetics of Paradise. Wonder translates the Latin admiratio, that's the Italian word, in English admiration, which actually is to be understood, admiratio, the Latin, the English admiration, but for the Middle Ages, it's nothing less than the sublime. If you wanted to translate medieval admiratio or admiration into an equivalent English, an aesthetic English term, would be the sublime, the pseudo-Dionysius idea of the sublime. It's not a romantic idea. It's probably, you are led to believe, it's an old idea. It's it's a Greek notion of indicating the mind that is overwhelmed with the spectacle of things that dwarf the mind, things that the mind cannot quite comprehend. That's the sublime. There can be the sublime in nature, there can be the sublime in art, there can be other forms of the sublime. Dante's mode of Paradise is indeed, this is the oscillation of a mind that is opening up, full of doubts, which really now, that's where he becomes subjective, critical, and then the experience of the sublime overwhelming him. But this idea of the sublime now introduces a picture of the universe, the way Beatrice will deliver it. She, therefore, after a sigh of pity, I love her, I must say, you know, the way she's going to treat Dante like a child at this point, after a sigh, bent her eyes on me with a look of a mother, a look her mother casts on her delirious child. Delirious in the etymological sense, I don't think that he's really actually crazy, delirious, or the word English, the word we use, delirium, simply means getting off the furrow. Delirium in Latin means the furrow. Wherever you go off the rut, as it were, or the furrow that you are tracing, then you are delirious. You are going off on your own in some kind of silly direction. And she began. That's the first picture of the universe. And we are going to find that this picture is going to be refined in a number of ways. But this is what he can understand now. All things, whatsoever, have order among themselves. That's the premise in Dante's Cosmos. And I will just add for you, and he continues, she continues, and this is the form that makes the universe resemble God. This is so, so that the universe has a likeness to the divinity. Two things to be said immediately. The word order, in case you don't know, is ordo, that O-R-D-O, means beauty. It's the idea that it's the symmetrical arrangement of proportionate light, full of light and clarity, structure of all, of the whole, ordo. This, even the word forma, one of it means form, means that there is a shape to things, but it translates the Latin pulchritudo, another synonym for beauty. The picture of the universe that Dante, that Beatrice evokes for Dante is one of beauty, which in turn implies vision, because beauty is defined that that which is seen gives me pleasure. This is the famous definition of Aquinas. That which is seen gives pleasure. That's beauty. It's a sort of subjective idea of beauty. Here, of course, Beatrice thinks of an objective order of the world. It's not the fact that I like it only, though Aquinas also gives that explanation of beauty. That which seen pleases, and that implies a self, a taste, a personal taste, a very, very rich medieval understanding of the aesthetic experience. But there is also an objective idea of the whole universe laid out in order, shape, clarity. These are the number, proportion, clarity. These are the attributes of beauty and this cosmological beauty. Let me just continue, because this line that the universe is resembles God seems to be such a nice way of thinking about the universe, but if you really think about it, it's really a heretical proposition. You know, the universe is like God. What about the evil that there is in the universe? It's the idea that there is a continuity between God's transcendence and God's immanence. What's he saying? I know that he's a little bit like Marcius, and he just likes to be a little better than Paul, or at least he's going to talk. But now this is really a strange statement, and therefore has to be clarified. And I think she will. I talk like this because I have to explain that I just was looking at a great text of in view of my class today. Last night I was looking at a great text by A.O. Lovejoy. So some of you may know him. He was one of the truly great, the inventor. If so one can speak this, of the whole idea of the history of ideas in the United States. He used to be a great professor in the 40s, 50s, and early 60s at Johns Hopkins, and he wrote a great book, which I still advise people to read, The Great Chain of Being, because that's really the idea. You know, The Great Chain of Being, it's this, what is this Great Chain of Being? It's this virtual metaphor of the continuity between the world of unity and the world of multiplicity and plurality. You know, and it implies that we are on that the whole universe is this arrangement, a chain, an invisible chain. It's an idea that reappears in the 18th century English literature. Pope, for instance, he uses this. I read this in Lovejoy. But it also implies it's a strange idea, because it implies that the value of things, the values of every entity, depends on the position one occupies in the various rings of the chain. So that if you're an angel, then you're really above human beings who are made of both, we are beastly and angelic at the same time. We have this kind of paradoxical quality of being spiritual and animal at the same time. And then according to that idea, though some of you may doubt it, we are better than dogs, and dogs are better than stones, and so on. You see, in a kind of hierarchy, a system of degrees. And he, Lovejoy, goes on saying, well, this is really the moment when Dante is adopting the idea of the great chain of being, and this great chain of being makes him really unorthodox. I want to tell you that that's not true, because I think we should read more carefully this passage. This is the beginning here, undoubtedly, about this resemblance, the universe resembles God. Here, Beatrice continues, the high creatures see the impress of the eternal excellence, which is the end of which that system itself is made. In the order I speak of, all natures have their bends. We all have our own specific gravity. We are all drawn, we all are drawn by our desires. We go where our desire takes us, our desires. And so there's a kind of natural instinct, a natural movement in this way in which a stone, if you drop it, falls always to the ground naturally because of its specific gravity. And the fire, if you light a candle, the fire will always go up instinctively. All things move according to their weight, according to their specific weight. It's a spiritual gravity. Now, are we like that? Is that really what Dante is saying? That's what he seems to be saying. According to the different laws, nearer to the source and farther from it, they move therefore to different ports over the great sea of being, each with an instinct given to it to bear it on. This bears fire up towards the moon. This is really a passage. Dante is rewriting a passage from Augustine's Confessions. This is the motive force in mortal creatures. This binds the earth together and makes it one. And not only the creature that are without intelligence as this bow shoot, but those who have intellect and love, meaning us. We have intellect and love. You know, remember the famous great poem about women who have intellect and love. Now we all have. Yes, she says, intellect and love. The providence that regulates all this makes forever quiet with its light the heaven within which turns out of the greatest speed on top, the primo mobile. And thither now, as to a place appointed, the power of thy bowstring is bearing us, which aims at a joyous mark. It is true. And now that's the correction to Lovejoy's interpretation. It is true that as a shape often does not accord with the art's intention because the material is deaf and unresponsive, so sometimes the creature, having the power that's impelled to turn aside another way, deviates from his course. And as fire may be seen to fall from a cloud, lightning, for instance, light does not go always up, light can go also down. And this fire may be seen to fall from a cloud, so the primal impulse, diverted by false pleasure, it turned to the earth. In other words, within this description of the order of the cosmos, Beatrice goes on to say that human beings are the odd figures, that we somehow have the power to deviate from this pattern of order, that we can undo. We have this paradoxical freedom that makes us either stay within a particular idea of what God may have meant or really for us, or really breach that particular order. Human beings are the third elements in this ordered portrait of the universe. And that is the whole statement of freedom, so that Dante is removing from a deterministic, that's what would make it into a heretical text, a deterministic idea of what the cosmos is. Then she turned her face again to the sky. Let me go, I'll go a little bit quickly on Canto 2. But I will need a few minutes. Canto 2, Dante now is on the sphere of the moon. You know that, and there'll be a discussion on the spot. There's this whole medieval legend. If you look at the moon, a full moon, you see the dark spots. And the legend was that Cain, in the medieval legend, that Cain, running away from the knowledge of the murder of his brother, had actually, with the help of God had removed him from the earth and had taken refuge there. And whatever we see there is just the imprint of Cain. Dante dismisses this legend, which goes on talking about science. She, Beatrice, will have a scientific discourse. And the question is this a natural cosmos or not? Do we see shades on the moon simply because there's a density, or not or rarity of matter? Or is it because, and therefore, light has a way of going through this matter of the moon according to a principle of more or less the rarity and density? Or is it because there's a different way in which light is distributed? The solution Dante gives, or Beatrice will give, is the second one. We see the shadows on the moon simply because there is a different source of light. In other words, the natural cosmos has to be understood in terms of its metaphysics. The physics can only be understood in terms of metaphysics. But what I want to stress to you is that the natural and the supernatural are always seen by Dante as holding hands together. They are not two separate worlds. They are not two separate dimensions. They are two different ways of looking at the same thing. But let's see how he introduces the canto, which I think is important for a number of reasons. Canto 2. O you who in a little bark, the language of humility is suspect at this point, because we know that the sublime is the mode, is the trope that he will use. Or you who in a little bark, you. He's addressing us. He's beginning addressing readers. Eager to listen, have followed behind my ship, the singing makes her way. Turn back to see your shores again. Do not put forth on the deep, for perhaps losing me, you would be left bewildered. The waters I take were never sailed before. Well, it gives poignancy to the little bark. It's a little bark because I'm engaged in such a magnificent, extraordinary adventure, right? The waters I take were never sailed before. Minerva breathes, Apollo pilots me, and the nine muses show me the bears. And then a restriction of the agents that he has been addressing. You are the few, kind of reductive apostrophe. The very few here, it's the la creme de la creme, you would say, of you guys, the very few who really know and are interested in the mysteries, in the most esoteric, arcane sciences that he's going to put out here. You are the few that reached out early, that the language actually says, turn your neck. This is really poor translation. I don't know what other translators say. You are the few who turn your neck, because this is the whole idea, another form of presumption. You may have heard, you may recall in the Bible about the stiff neck, right? The stiff neck, the of course the neck is always the emblem of conversion. For Plato, you reach a conversion, you really turn the neck. That's all you do toward, not for Dante, you turn upside down, but in Plato you turn the neck and you know where the source of light is. The biblical counter to that is that maybe the stiff neck, those who lack humility, right? Behind this metaphor, there is the whole idea that what makes a human being, that what confers dignity to a human being, is the power that we, among all animals, have to look up at the sky and see and look at the stars and therefore wonder. All other animals are always looking down, right? We are alone. Of course, there are other people who believe that what makes human beings, gives particular dignity to human beings, is something else. Of all of them, as those who said that we speak, of course, but of all of them, the one I really like is that we are capable of laughing. That's the explanation. It's an Aristotelian idea, but it's explanation of comedy too. Here, that's the allusion, though. You are a few who could be also implying, like me, that do not be too arrogant about this, who that reached out early for angels' bread, knowledge, by which men here live but never come from it satisfied. You may indeed put forth your vessel on the salt depths, holding my furrow before the water returns smooth again. Those glorious ones who crossed the sea to Colchis were not amazed. Once again, the language of admiration. The language is sublime. I'll come to this in a moment. As you shall be when they saw Jason turn plowing. Okay, well, the metaphor of the journey by water to describe now an aerial journey. So an anti-Dante is clearly thinking of that metaphoric compression that we saw in Ulysses. Remember the sailing that became a mad flight. Now here if a flight that becomes a sailing. And the notion that he's guiding us, so the sense of his responsibility, he's turning us back, unlike Ulysses. Okay, we dispose of that mythic resonance very quickly. But what he's really saying is that the journey we're undertaking, which is the reading of this book, can become extraordinarily dangerous. And why the reason why it becomes dangerous is because it's traveling over water that leaves no wake behind it. This is the what I would call the danger of the seafaring. In seafaring, you have no pre-established routes. There is nothing, there's no way, no road, no path that can be there fixed and you can find. So he's inviting us to keep very close to him, but we might be losing him at the same time. The journey by water is not exactly like the journey by land because there are no pre-established directions marked for us. And then finally, this allusion to Jason. So he's not like Ulysses, he's like the hero of the Argonauts who has gone looking for the golden fleece. And it's an image that reappears at the end of Paradiso 33, where Dante has the god Neptune from the depth wondering at the extraordinary power of the human imagination, the human will. They wonder at the heroics of Jason. And Neptune is without, he can't quite believe what he sees. It's clearly an allusion to what Dante himself is going to do in seeing God face to face and then returning to the earth. But what I want to emphasize, and here really I will stop and give you a chance to ask me some questions, is that we probably never read, I think we skipped Canto 18 of Inferno. I think we did. I don't think that I asked you to read it. And I don't presume that you would go and read what I don't ask you to read. So you never really did. But in Canto 18, Dante, you there, if you go and read Canto 18 of Inferno, you will find Jason punished among the flatterers and the seducers. Because he is the famous for seducing Hypsipyle and abandoning her. Okay, it's a version of what happened to Theseus and Medea. It's one of the great fixations of Greek, one of the great situations of a repeated situation of a Greek tragedy. But the interesting thing is that Dante now is distinguishing between the ethical judgment of Jason, who is behind in Inferno 18, and the imaginative, aesthetic value of the adventure itself. Now, is he saying therefore that the good and the beautiful are really two distinct things? He's warning us about that. And that's where I want to pick up the conversation next time, where we are going to be talking about the value of images and the ethics of images. But let me finish here now and see if there are some questions which I will try to answer. Please.
You just talked about the analogy of turning your minds to the bread of angels. And then you talked about the image of water and all of those images, that symbols that come in. But it seems a little strange to me that you're talking about, I have the Manual Poem translation, but that you're turning your mind to bread is very strange, it seems. So I was just wondering if you could talk about the symbolism or significance of that, is turning your mind to bread.
The question is about explaining the image of bread in the beginning of Canto 2 of Paradise, where Dante says, addressing the readers, that they are turning their neck too early to the bread of angels. But I have a question for you. In what way do you find it strange?
I just mean, well, I have mind instead of turning your neck, but just
okay.
Talking about the intellect, but then bread.
All right, okay. The bread of angels. So I would say the bread of angels. And the bread of angels is knowledge. So I think that the implied, the transference, the metaphorical reading by Mandelbaum is accurate. I wish it were more literal, but just as I think that my own translation, of course, St. Clair also, it's one of the few times that he deviates from the literal burden, because the literal burden of the metaphor has a number of resonances which I think are valuable, like exactly the stiff neck, the turning of the neck. In a context like paradise, where Dante starts out by clearly locating himself within some contradictory possibilities, the possibility of a transgression or the possibility of trespassing, in the case of Paul. So, where exactly is he? So that image is his by the image of the turning of the neck. Early for the bread of the angels is also reverberates with anxieties that he has about his own adventure and his own enterprise. That's, I don't know if this answers your perplexity, but
yeah, just so the bread of angels is really knowledge.
The bread of angels is knowledge. Yeah, that which, you know, it's the idea that you find in the banquet. That why do philosophers, well, I'm sure that it's literally true that there is nothing better for a great philosophical conversation than, you know, a glass of wine, and you sit around and you talk, but it clearly is the food of knowledge, the food of the mind, the food of knowledge, the taste of knowledge, etc. All those metaphors. Yes, since that's very good. That's very good, because I think, can that be also grace? Yes, that's very good, because we are here in the world of paradise, and I know that I'm giving a kind of sort of philosophical emphasis, but there is also the theological. We are dealing with the poetic more than the philosophical, the poetic and the theological together. Absolutely. Very good. Thank you. Other questions? Please.
When he describes how God sheds more or less pure mena light on different parts. The phrase pure mena was also used in Purgatory to describe different aesthetic perspectives. Is Dante trying to bring that in here, or is he just talking about the hierarchy of who God chooses to shed light on?
Well, good. The question is in line 3 of Paradiso 1, Dante uses the phrase more and less, talk about the light that shines on creation according to a principle of more and less. And then the concern is that Dante uses this phrase quite often in Canto 10 of Purgatory, where in the world context of art, there is that phrase about, I call it approximation. Is Dante joining the two? Does he want us to put the two things together? And let me answer that. Far be it from me ever to say, no, Dante does not want us to do that. The whole reading, I mean, if there's a principle to the way I read, is that the more echoes you can find, the better I think that we serve. Whether we understand the poem and we serve what I take it to be the intention of the poet. But I had never really conjoined the two in my own mind for one simple reason, because here I think it's Dante's asserting the principle of hierarchy. I think that in Purgatorio, Dante's doing something completely different. Since it's the context there, is pride, he's really reversing all forms what is the measure of the human beings? How do we measure human beings? I could say that this is actually a problem that goes here. Every time you have a hierarchy, you know, I'm really placing myself in between an order, a rank of different values. And so I can say that that is also happening in Canto 1. But frankly, the context would not allow me to go far too much beyond this. So yeah, there is a way in which every time I talk of hierarchy, I'm talking about a rank ordering, and therefore the sense of my place, it's a little bit removed from the concerns here. It's there, but not the most compelling argument for me. You may prove me wrong, of course, but I would say this issue appears. There, you know, we join things together. Let's try to keep also each entity in its own specificity, so that we really understand that the how far his thinking can go with a representation of a scene and then another. But I like that. Good. I like the fact that you join, you combine. Yes. The question is, who on earth could Dante's audience be? We know who the audience of Homer, Virgil can be, is. But who? What about the audience for Dante? Someone who has to know philosophy, theology, and so on. And my answer is, you're right, that we do know roughly about Homer, because after all, there is always Demodocus in the Odyssey who is singing to the audience at court till Ulysses appears and rhapsodes, and Homer is the one of the rhapsodes, or maybe the one who stitches together the voices of the rhapsodes. That gives us a miniature account of an audience. With Dante is a little bit more difficult to understand. I can tell you now, contemporary poets think that Dante's poem, especially Inferno, ought to be read in the streets, like really rhapsodes going on the ancient Greece. They would go from one fair, one marketplace, and the day of the market to another, and gather people together, the feast days of the community. But I can be a little bit more romantic, that I think it's true, but that Dante probably did read some of his cantos when he was in Ravenna or Verona to the in the evening gathering, the circles of courtiers. But I don't think of Dante as a courtier. You know, he doesn't seem to have the values. He has aristocratic values of the mind, of course, but he doesn't seem to share the social problems of the court. I can think of some aspects of Shakespeare being the poet of the court, the poet who would be read by the queen, and he wants the queen to read his texts, or the theater. We know about the theater. A part of Paradiso was not known at all. Some people, the first 10 cantos were sent to the patron, who would probably give him what today we would call a grant. You know, you apply for a grant, who would give him a gift for the great extraordinary dedication. That's what patrons would, the role they would play. But I think that Dante, and this is going to be very romantic, it's Ara Benjamin now. I think that Dante writes this kind of poetry at the end for God. I don't think that he could care. I don't think he has an empirical audience in mind. He really means it, the few. I don't think it's a rhetorical strategy at the end. You few who are going to read that. And it's too much written, it's written too much in the mode of a quest for God, you know, a prayer. Actually, it's a moment at one point where language bends into a prayer, and with the language of a longing that goes with prayer, that I really think it's meant for God. I mean it in a very serious way, and ends with a prayer. The great Canto 33 is an extraordinary prayer. So that's my answer. I'm sure that I have a dear friend who wants to make a movie about reading Dante in the streets, and that's fine. But I'm not sure that's what Dante thought. I mean, I really am not sure about that. Great question. Thank you. See you next time.